Welcome to CMDA's Voice of Advocacy podcast. Here's your host, Dr. Brick Lance.
Well, we have a unique podcast for you today, and I have my co-worker with me in the studio today, J.C. Bicek, who took over Nicole Hayes' job as the State Policy Director for the American Academy of Medical Ethics. But JC and I were in school at the same time, even though we're decades apart in age, pursuing our Master's of Bioethics at Trinity University. So today, we are going to discuss bioethical issues. Welcome, JC.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Lance. This is exciting.
Yeah, so maybe we'll make this a regular. In fact, I'm going to ask our listeners, if you've come across an article, a commentary that you would like us to discuss, send it in. But let me tell you what we're going to discuss. Four categories today. We're going to discuss genetic manipulation. We're going to discuss sexuality, particularly as it pertains to children. We're also going to discuss organ transplantation and death. And then we're going to have a little twist on community health. Mm-hmm. That's going to be an interesting twist there at the end. Let's go to our first category, and let's talk about genetic manipulation. I have two articles here to discuss, and the reason I chose these two articles, JC, is they're kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum of what's good and what's bad. So I have that common question in general. Do you have an opinion? Is technology good or bad, or is technology itself neutral in how we use it?
I think that it really depends on the person using it and their sort of assessment of what is good. In any case, going into it, we can't say that technology is itself neutral, as we might like to. It's really, why was that technology created in the first place?
Okay. And I think I'm changing my opinion over time. I used to approach all technology as neutral, but I think there clearly is technology that is harmful and there's technology that is helpful. Mm-hmm. And so let's get into these two arguments. So one, this just came out a couple months ago from my home state, Oregon Health Sciences University, on in vitro gametogenesis. So we'll discuss that. And then the other article I want to discuss is personalized gene editing and the case of one baby who was cured of a fatal genetic mutation. But let's go to IVG, in vitro gametogenesis. So the scientists took skin cells and they removed the nucleus and then took the nucleus, implanted it into a woman's egg, with which its nucleus had been removed. So they're making basically a human egg with the genome of whoever the skin cell was donated by. And then, of course, then they fertilize that with a sperm. So this technique could overcome infertility due to old age or diseases, and by using almost any cell in the body. But again, it has this moral dilemma. What about same-sex couples? In other words, two males having a genetically related child. But anyway, this is interesting. They didn't get very far, so this is probably still decades in the future as far as any mm-hmm. practical use. But they did get these cells to survive for at least 6 days. And this was in the Journal of Nature Communications. What are your thoughts on this, JC?
There are a lot of thoughts. I mean, just one of the first things you said, we can overcome infertility for old age or disease. This is one of the first lines. And then they get into same-sex couples. Those are all three different things. And we're talking about, are they all morally equal? So I think if we were just to say that, for some sort of disease, like we have an opportunity to, help somebody who would otherwise be unable to have children, that's a starting point for that conversation. When we're talking about old age, well, aren't there other ways to figure out how a woman might become pregnant? Like maybe start earlier.
Yeah. And what if there was this famous athlete that you got to shake hands? Could you not just steal some of his skin cells and get his nucleus?
There's certainly those privacy security issues.
Yeah. And I also find it fascinating. So this is from OHSU in Oregon, but there's other medical facilities and academic centers all over the United States, in fact, all over the world, that are doing all kinds of de novo genetic manipulation and trying to study it. But there's no regulation in this. There's no guidance to this. So it's like a brave new world we're living in. Who should be guiding this research?
That's who is a good question. But I think before you get to that, we've accepted this idea that, like, well, of course these things are good and we should therefore pursue them. And, you know, we almost can't even, this idea of who should regulate them is, it just totally already appreciates the idea that, like, what we're after is ultimately good.
Yeah.
And I can't quite, it's unfortunate that we're already there.
Yeah. And the way they write the article is, yes, they really do believe this is good, particularly for the infertile couple, and I put infertility in quotes, because that can imply many, many different things. But anyway, who knows if this will ever come to fruition in the future, but it's an interesting article to discuss. Let's go to this next article, and this is from Nature. Personalized gene editing helped one baby, can it be rolled out widely? Now, this one is actually quite fascinating. It was a newborn with a very rare genetic mutation, and unable to produce the enzyme called carbamol phosphate synthetase 1, or CPS1, and that's a crucial enzyme from the liver that detoxifies particularly ammonia, and it is fatal. And so the only known cure up until this time has been a liver transplant. And it's rare. It's only 1 out of 1 million births. But for this baby, they were able to use a CRISPR-like mechanism and change the genome of this baby. And it took them about 6 months, and the baby is alive. Now, this is good, is it not?
I think in some senses, this is what good moral medicine would maybe point to, is this idea of this individual patient, and we want to treat them, and we care for that person. That it says that this issue is 1 in 1 million children. So it's not as if we can generate, come up with certain therapies that can be, scaled. That's just not possible. So how do we care for certain people in those circumstances? And I think we start to get at that idea that there is something good about care, helping this individual.
Yeah. Now, of course, technology is regulated in our country. I can't comment how it's regulated around the world, but we do have the FDA and other organizations that will approve new technology and such things as CRISPR. In fact, adult CRISPR, which is the gene editing program, can be used in the United States for sickle cell anemia. It's expensive. I don't know how much it costs to do the treatment for this child, but for an adult with sickle cell anemia to get a CRISPR treatment, which is marvelous for treating this, is about $2 million for an human being. So there's an economic issue, which also brings in ethics. Distribution of resources. Who's available for this and who's not? So that'll be another ethical situation here. And of course, there's other multiple mutations that are fatal. And which ones are we going to manipulate or not? Who's going to make those decisions?
The first note that I wrote at the top of the paper was just, this raises tough questions. There are certainly tough questions here. But I think we're acknowledging that there's some goodness. Obviously, there's some significant hurdles, like the cost. But then, where do we go? Let's just say that it was readily available and affordable for all. Do we move on from rare diseases to preferences in genes? And yeah. I think that's something that we see already in, pretty clearly companies set up to create embryos for you, screen them and set them up so that you get all the traits that you want. So if this was to become readily available, then there aren't great significant moral hurdles to still overcome.
Yeah. And then that could go down another slippery slope. And then we start discarding the ones we don't want, even though they would live.
Mm-hmm.
So that ends up being a form of eugenics, if you will.
But we already struggle with this. Like, who's to say, I want to take this medication to improve this cognitive ability, this ability, this ability. And very few regulators are saying you can't do that. So to think that we're going to proscribe this idea of gene manipulation or, choosing traits, it's going to be really hard to see how anybody's going to regulate that, especially in our, very sort of liberal autonomous society that prizes such things.
So I'm glad there are institutions out there that train Christian bioethicists, because we need to stay on top of this genetic manipulation, again, because it can be used for good or for bad. Now, let's go to our next topic, and that's on sexualities. And JC, I was disgusted when I first read... read this first article, and there's a journal called Sex and Sexualities, and this is just from a couple months ago in 2025. The title of the article is Childhood Sexualities on Pleasure and Meaning from the Margins. Now, I'm going to read, JC, I'm going to read the abstract. And this is hard for me to read because some of it, I'm not even sure what they're saying, to be honest. But they talk about, just to preface reading this abstract, feminist, queer, and decolonial perspectives. So that gives you an idea of what this is about. And it mentions that the sexual innocence that suppressed young people's desires and it's opening pathways towards gender and sexual justice. I'm not sure what sexual justice is. And it talks at the very end, just sexual futures. So let me just read this abstract. Sexualities scholarship marginalizes childhood sexual pleasures. That's alarming, just that first phrase. Positioning children as vulnerable subjects. This article repositions childhood sexualities within a pleasure-centered, globally oriented, and power-aware frame informed by feminist, queer, and decolonial perspectives. That's a mouthful. Drawing on Southern research from South Africa and other contexts, we interrogate dominant narratives of sexual innocence that suppress young people's desires. I'm going to come back to that. There are some desires we should suppress and show how children negotiate pleasure and meaning amid intersecting hierarchies of age, race, gender, and class. By centering margins, we reveal pleasure as both contested and generative, exposing the workings of domination while opening pathways toward gender and sexual justice. We argue that rejecting adult-centric adultist approaches to sexualities and attending to childhood pleasure is indispensable for an inclusive sociology and just sexual futures. What's your thoughts on a just sexual futures with children?
I'm sorry, my note was, what decadent nonsense. Just sexual futures. Brick, this is several pages long at least, but this abstract really, you don't need to go much further. We can. Towards gender and sexual justice, what, there's an important question we can ask. What is justice? I hear it all the time. What does it mean?
So I'm going to have to ask you a couple questions, JC, but let me just read a couple phrases from within the paper. Scholarship has often emphasized danger over desire, highlighting the risk of sex while marginalizing discussion of pleasure. We should. What's wrong with that? There is danger, particularly when you're a child. I'm going to come back to that. The other one, near the end, affirming the pursuit of pleasure is a vital part of being and becoming human, even more for the young. Mm-hmm. Now, this, JC, this gets back to hedonism. Mm-hmm. And pleasure. And you and I, we had to take ethical theory classes in mm-hmm. our master's, and I'm just going to read some off. These are all these ethical theories. And I've said this on the podcast before. I think secular ethical theories is an oxymoron because I think ethics needs to be combined with Christianity. Mm-hmm. But anyway, here's some of the theories we studied. Virtue ethics, utilitarianism, deontology, consequentialism, social contract theory, Kantianism, virtue theory, care ethics, contractarianism, ethical egoism, feminist ethics, natural law theories, and then hedonism was even one that we studied. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with hedonism, JC?
We were saying before that there's an aspect of seeking pleasure that can be well reasoned and appreciated. You know, we go out to a nice dinner. You know, we seek out opportunities to engage with, you know, our friends and family, and we take pleasure in that. But certainly putting things in their proper perspective, putting things in order. And like I said, the idea that I used the word decadent, but that's suggesting that, like, what sort of other things are we just totally overlooking as important here? If we're pursuing pleasure, I mean, now this is all about sexual pleasure. And I mean, again, there's just so much here and we don't have time to get into all of this today, but pursuit, but in what order?
Yeah. You know, this is alive and well in our culture if people don't understand this. So I'm just going to tell you from my community. In my community, Eugene, Oregon, mm-hmm. the school district, there is a LGBTQ club for third and fourth graders. How does a third and fourth grader understand, well, first of all, the whole acronym of LGBTQ, but gender identity and sexual preference? It's craziness. So the Oregon Health Authority sent out a survey last week to all public school sixth graders. It was 19 questions on the survey asking sixth graders their gender identity, and they listed dozens of options of their gender identity, their sexual preferences for sixth graders, and 19 different questions on this. Mm-hmm. This is from the Oregon Health Authority, by the way. I'm going to tell you another story. So this was over a decade ago, and this had to do with the pregnancy center I'm a medical director at, but I got wind of a mainline Protestant denominational church having a parent night. And because we reach out to communities about sexual health from our pregnancy center. But I thought I need to go to this even though I don't have a child there. So I invited two other mature Christian men to go with me. I didn't want to go by myself. And the guest speaker was the state director of Planned Parenthood. Over 45 minutes, told the parents, there's about 100 parents there, how healthy it was for their teenagers to have sex in their youth group. So the youth group leader got up after her and said, this is why I provide condoms for all your high school students in our youth group, mainline denominational church. So the reaction, all three of us, we didn't have children there, and not a hand of a parent went up. We actually went out to our vehicle and got our knees and prayed. I was so nauseated. I was nauseated by this. I think this is a battle worth fighting, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, I think, and you say we, and you were an adult going, and you didn't have children that were involved. But there's a quote from on page 193. It says, this alludes to something you mentioned a moment ago. We seek to disrupt dominant narratives that efface childhood sexual pleasure. We re-envision children's sexuality. Who are we? These are adults. Why are these? I said, why are adults? They should not be envisioning sexual or children's sexuality. What a strange, strange world. But even then, you know, you talk about as adults, like what is the purpose? You know, we talk about desire, we talk about harm. What is the purpose of an adult in our society but to protect children, right? There's this idea of, oh, we're overplaying harm. I that's what I understand. Yeah, you know, I have three young children at the moment. What is my duty but to protect them?
Right. And then Katie Faust with her organization, Them Before Us, and she was on our podcast here recently. She says all children have a right to innocence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I really believe that's true. If we take away their right to innocence, we have chaos. We have utterly disaster. And we certainly fall away from God's design for human beings. All right, let's go to this next.
I want to go ahead. One more thing.
Yeah.
It's funny you said that because I do have a note here that said, I would like to hear Katie Faust respond to this article.
Okay. We'll give her a call. Listen, this next one is also a little bit sickening. This is actually a commentary. It's written by Katie McCoy, who's a Christian author, and it's The Brave New World of Cyber Brothels. And this gets back to Aldous Huxley's novel, Brave New World, which is written over a century ago. Mm-hmm. And boy, did he have a vision of the future, which is taking place. But in Germany, you have these cyber brothels, and they basically have artificial women. Of course, it's designed for men, with combining virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and other emerging technologies. Call this a cyber brothel. And they have robotically engineered lifelike humanoids. And here, the owner of this, and first of all, they don't have to have a brothel license like other brothels in Germany because they're not a human. They're humanoids with AI and all this stuff. And there's no infidelity because you're not cheating on your spouse. And I put that in
No, that's
quotes.
What he said.
That's what they say. Here's one of the owners, and this is, quote, the only person who can judge you is yourself, end quote. That reminds me of the last verse in the book of Judges. Everyone did what is right in their own eyes.
How did that go?
It didn't go very well. And so this is, again, according to Katie McCoy, just reducing human sexuality to a mere biological drive, like we're animals. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, also that idea that only, what he writes, the only person who can judge is yourself. I think that we need to try to include more shame in our society, in our culture, when we think about things like that. There's an element of shame that is good. Yeah, I think one of the things that stands out is this idea of we were, you know, animals. What is real? What is good? But I hear so much from younger generations, mine, the Gen Z and such, that they, you know, they are complaining that the world that was promised to them didn't pan out, right? They were, you could be whatever you want to be. Well, that's not really true. You can't, you know, you everybody wants to be, you know, a surgeon or a banker, and we're not all equally gifted in that way. So they were promised that, and now they're really disappointed that the world hasn't shaped up. But what are we setting them up for here? How can this be different? I think this idea that reality shouldn't sort of be a any sort of limitation for us has not provided health almost in any facet. Fortunately, it seems like animals at least accept this idea of reality and live within it. But I also wonder what could be more human than dealing with reality? You know, where if we're experiencing a sinful world in which we want to escape, I think the human thing there is to realize our need for Christ. Like that's what we see when we enter. But on the other hand, they're trying to just escape reality, escape this nature.
Yeah, so that's why the church needs to be aware of what's going on in the world, and we need to promote God's design again, mm-hmm. a man and a woman together for life. Because one is, we could have brought in a number of sociological articles that the greatest happiness occurs in that situation if we mm-hmm. live by God's mm-hmm. design. And that's proven over and over in sociological studies. But the average visitors for these cyber brothels are men in their mid-30s. Talk about breakdown of the family and destroying marriage. And again, the epidemic of loneliness and isolation and purposelessness. It's just taking pornography to a deeper level. And pornography is destroying it. It just dehumanizes.
And we're seeing so many studies that suggest that. And so why would we continue to push forward with something that seems to be even more destructive? That's tough.
All right, we're going to get two more topics. Third topic, we're going to talk just briefly about organ transplantation and death. And I will refer our listeners to go back and to listen to the Voice of Advocacy podcast with Dr. Ott. He's a cardiac transplant doctor, and ethics is deeply involved in, one, defining death, but also organ harvesting and organ transplantation. And what I want to get to, JC, is let me just talk about a couple things, but who should be making these ethical decisions? Because there's a lot of ethics involved. Mm-hmm. I always like to state that new technology always brings ethical dilemmas. And in the 1960s, when the cardiopulmonary machine was basically developed and instituted, and the modern ICU was developed, before that, death was easy to find. I mean, someone stopped breathing. I mean, you could do CPR, but, you know, you have to quit at some point. If they don't get a pulse and they don't breathe, they're dead. Now, with technology, we can keep people alive longer. Mm-hmm. But what is our goal in keeping them alive? And then when are they truly dead? That's difficult to define sometimes. In fact, that has significant ramifications in this organ donation. And one is the title of this article is Reviving Organs, Redefining Death, The Ethical Controversy Over Normothermic Regional Perfusion and the Way Around It. And again, there is this 5-minute rule when they take someone that's in ICU on a cardiopulmonary machine. And there's different ways. Again, go back and listen to the podcast. But when you stop the perfusion or stop the ventilation, I'm sorry, for 5 minutes and they remain pulseless for 5 minutes, you can harvest the organs. The problem is the organs now have 5 minutes without any perfusion. And so now you can declare them dead, but the organs are not quite as good mm-hmm. as if you kept them alive. So what they do is perfuse them, going into the femoral arteries, veins, and you actually reverse the perfusion as far as the flow, clamp the arteries to the brain, the carotids. Now, again, there's still vertebral arteries, they're not clamping, but that then the quote, the brain is dead, so then you can harvest the organ by bypassing this 5-minute rule. Anyway, this has all kinds of ethical implications because, one, if you wait the 5 minutes, there's some people who don't die and they maintain their perfusion, and then you can't harvest, or you should not harvest their organs. There are organ reconditioning methods that are being invented, including the hypothermic machine perfusion, and then simply perfusing the organs after they're harvested with different techniques. But there's the dead donor rule, and that can be broken, if you will, by some of this clamping. And again, Dr. Ott has some significant thoughts on that. But here's my question. Who should be regulating all of this? We need, you know, with technology in the United States, we need to have some regulation. So who's to regulate this for us? Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on that?
you know, we work in public policy, we should probably have some well-prepared remarks on who should be regulating. It is a tough question. It really is. And I really appreciated Dr. Ott. I think I'd like to think that, you know, doctors like Dr. Ott would be regulating these things. But it's a huge question because, you know, and what the article gets at and underscores is this idea of there's an erosion of trust in what we're seeing in organ donation. Like there is a perverse incentive to kill somebody for the sake of their organs, to you know, heal somebody else. I mean, that sounds like a good thing. We're serving somebody else. But on the other hand, there are people moving away from who previously supported organ donation because they're understanding that, you know, in some cases, at what point are they dead and who's determining that and why? Like, I think you began with that question. Why are we determining? And this is just a huge question because if we think at all that organ donation is good, we need to establish trust in this process. And I think there's a lot of clouded judgment. Judgment is easily clouded in this field.
Yeah, and so there needs to be some federal oversight. There is the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, and they definitely need to have some oversight. I will state that, so in Canada, do you know that they're taking patients that die from MAID, medical assistance in dying, using their organs for transplantation? That just doesn't feel right to me.
No, yeah, I mean, getting into the those ethical theories that you acknowledged earlier, this utilitarian idea, like, you know, do the means justify the ends or vice versa? And killing people to the sake to save others is
You know, there's this financial incentive too. So again, in China, it's some surgeons have fled because they were forced to harvest organs from live individuals because they could sell them. Americans would fly over to China and get their transplant, you know, pay their $100,000 if they had it to get their organ of choice. And they were killing innocent people to get their organs. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say there is a benefit as a recipient. So in orthopedics, we used allografts. And I used to harvest when I was a resident, made lots of money. So after the organs were harvested by the other team, I would come in and harvest the bones and joints and tendons and ligaments. Mm-hmm. Has to be harvested very sterilely, surgical technique, and then kind of reconstruct the bodies. And not to be gross, but after I take out the femurs, I put wooden dowels in there. So for the funeral service that, you know, they have a body. But what happens is when I implant those into a patient, when I take an allograft, so a donor tissue, they are given access to be able to write a thank you to the family that donated that material. And there is a benefit to that. There is some good science to it. But it does need regulation. It needs regulation, other we get into a crazy world.
And to suggest otherwise, like you acknowledged, there are other countries that are not regulating things or are encouraging these. Even in Canada, not to say that they're encouraging, but at the same time, they're certainly encouraging in some sense this idea that, you know, we should take life into our own hands, but then you ask why, and it can lead to this very quickly.
In fact, I'll just, here's a article, if you want to look this up. It's Ethical Issues in Organ Transplantation, a position paper from the American College of Physicians. Lead author is Carl, with a K-L, Espenson, E-S-B-E-N-S-E-N. It's a great article because he does go through the ethical issues that are involved, and he states five of them. I'm not going to read all of them, and they're very well stated. And again, there's no Christianity brought into this. It's just basic ethics. Anyway, I find that a very well-written article on that.
Yeah, I would commend that. It's in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and it's robust insofar as thinking through. And I think, you know, he acknowledges that idea of trust several times and encouraging participation. We need to maintain trust.
Yeah, and trust is essential maintaining the field of medicine, that not only the patient-doctor trust, but the public trust as well. So we don't want to violate what are just abhorrent ethics. So let's go to our last topic, and we're going to talk about community and environmental health, and particularly when it comes to our water sources. And this is very interesting. So these are more commentaries and proposed laws, and I'm going to give two of them to you. So the first is on understanding the chemical abortion drug mifepristone, now that it's the most common way for a woman to kill their baby. But that mifepristone, because it's so common use now and you can just order it online, is entering the water system, okay? Now, here's what else is entering our water system. So when you abort that baby, you flush it down the toilet. So human parts are entering our water system. So Wisconsin has a bill that is being proposed called the Clean Water for All Life Act. And that is to have women strain their aborted baby with a strainer when they abort at home so they can bring the body parts back in to the physician or the medical facility so it does not enter the water system. Interesting. I think Maine has also a similar bill that they're discussing. And you think about it, all kinds of substances enter our water system. That's why we regulate farms. We regulate manufacturing. We even ask people to bring their illicit drugs back without charges so it doesn't enter our public health system and they can be disposed of properly. Even hospitals have to follow strict regulation of disposing of body parts, and we don't have that in the abortion industry. And all kinds of pharmaceuticals we carefully measure within our public water. So again, it makes total sense on certainly human body parts not being disposed of down the toilet. And then Senator James Lankford has proposed, along with Congressman Josh Breachin of Environment and Public Health Risk of Abortion Drug Mifepristone, and they want some investigation. Is this entering our water supply? Now, they quote a 1996 article where from the EPA that it's not at risk, but the problem was that was 30 years ago, and mifepristone was not even legal in our country at that time. It wasn't legalized until 2000. So they want an investigation, and rightly so. I mean, this may even affect natural wildlife and fish and such, let alone is it a potential cause for the increased infertility that we're seeing in the United States?
Yeah, he raises that issue.
Yeah. So what do you think about our public health in the abortion industry? Thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think our first priority certainly is just the pro-life initiative. But moving on from there, I think there's this unique opportunity to find like cause with different organizations. And we do that in other fields on other topics like assisted suicide. You know, we're partnered with some really diverse coalitions. This is an opportunity to hopefully work with some people that, you know, who are otherwise interested in, like you said, you know, environmentalism, who may have overlooked this or may have thought otherwise, and maybe they have means to say, maybe we should be rethinking this sort of just no sort of regulation of mifepristone because it is having other consequences that I didn't foresee. And then I would like to use that as a conversation to start with, well, if you think that this is an issue for, you know, for life on this side of the womb, how do you think that it impacts life on the other side of the womb?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Should that not be a concern of ours as well? If we're being morally consistent, at least.
And here's what I think. I think that natural law, moral law, is all consistent with God's design. Mm-hmm. In other words, if we study environmental impact, if it's having a negative impact, then we're violating God's creation. Now, again, as Christians, we believe that abortion is wrong in general, in principle. But the rest of the world doesn't think that way. Mm-hmm. So let's do take the arguments about natural law, public health, other issues that we can bring to the table, because I think that's all the sound reality arguments are always on our side. And I think it's a very creative way to help stimulate further discussion on the topic of abortion.
Yeah, fully. I would just say, what does the environment matter if not for the people who inhabit it? And if not, you know, life, if we're suggesting that life is important, then certainly that must extend into the womb from the moment of fertilization. It's just, again, to be morally consistent, but to see that, yeah, we want to protect the environment. We want to protect this world that God has given. We want to be good stewards of all things. And I think there's opportunities here to show and to encourage participation among, you know, broad groups in fighting for life.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I don't think bioethicists will ever be out of a job in our world. We need very intelligent people. We need Christian bioethicists, but just sound thinkers. So yeah, so we can guide policy, guide decision-making within our culture, influence the culture, help the church be the church to do what's right and live according to God's design. Hey, this has been really fun, JC.
Yes,
and I encourage
thank
our
you.
Listeners, you know, email us at advocacy@cmda.org. If you find an article you'd like us to discuss and put other people's attention to it, please let us know. And there's endless opportunities to discuss bioethics here at CMDA. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to CMDA's Voice of Advocacy podcast. If you would like to suggest a future guest or share a comment with us, please email us at advocacy@cmda.org. And if you like the podcast, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share it on your favorite social media platform. This podcast has been a production of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.